bestowed a carpet of fine wool, of a pattern which imitated the spots of a peacock's tail, of a magnitude to overspread the floor of a new church, erected in the triple name of Christ, of Michael the Archangel, and of the prophet Elijah. She gave 600 pieces of silk and linen, of various use and denomination. The silk was painted with the Tyrian dye, and adorned by the labors of the needle, and the linen was so exquisitely fine that an entire piece might be rolled in the hollow of a cane. In his description of the Greek manufactures, an historian of Sicily discriminates their price according to the weight and quality of the silk, the closeness of the texture, the beauty of the colors, and the taste and materials of the embroidery. A single or even a double or treble thread was thought sufficient for ordinary sale, but the union of 6 threads composed a piece of stronger and more costly workmanship. Among the colors he celebrates with affection of eloquence the fiery blaze of the scarlet and the softer luster of the green. The embroidery was raised either in silk or gold. The more simple ornament of stripes or circles was surpassed by the nicer imitation of flowers. The vestments that were fabricated for the palace or the altar often glittered with precious stones, and the figures were delineated in strings of oriental pearls. Till the 12th century, Greece alone, of all the countries of Christendom, was possessed of the insect who is taught by nature, and of the workmen who are instructed by art to prepare this elegant luxury. But the secret had been stolen by the dexterity and diligence of the Arabs. The caliphs of the East and West scorned to borrow from the unbelievers their furniture and apparel. And 2 cities of Spain, Almeria and Lisbon, were famous for the manufacture, the use, and perhaps the exportation of silk. It was first introduced into Sicily by the Normans, and this emigration of trade distinguishes the victory of Roger from the uniform and fruitless hostilities of every age. After the sack of Corinth, Athens, and Thebes, his lieutenant embarked with a captive train of weavers and artificers of both sexes, a trophy glorious to their masters and disgraceful to the Greek emperor. The king of Sicily was not insensible of the value of the present, and in the restitution of the prisoners he accepted only the male and female manufacturers of Thebes and Corinth, who labor, says the Byzantine historian, under a barbarous lord, like the old Eritreans in the service of Darius. A stately edifice in the palace of Palermo was erected for the use of this industrious colony, and the art was propagated by their children and disciples to satisfy the increasing demand of the Western world. The decay of the looms of Sicily may be ascribed to the troubles of the island and the competition of the Italian cities. In the year 1314, Lucca alone, among her sister republics, enjoyed the lucrative monopoly. A domestic revolution dispersed the manufacturers to Florence, Bologna, Venice, Milan, and even the countries beyond the Alps. And 13 years after this event, the statues of Modena enjoined the planting of mulberry trees and regulated the duties on raw silk. The northern climates are less propitious to the education of the silkworm, but the industry of France and England is supplied and enriched by the productions of Italy and China. I must repeat the complaint that the vague and scanty memorials of the times will not afford any just estimate of the taxes, the revenue, and the resources of the Greek Empire. From every province of Europe and Asia, the rivulets of gold and silver discharged into the imperial reservoir a copious and perennial stream. The separation of the branches from the trunk increased the relative magnitude of Constantinople, and the maxims of despotism contracted the state to the capital to the palace, and the palace to the royal person. A Jewish traveller who visited the East in the 12th century is lost in his admiration of the Byzantine riches. "It is here," says Benjamin of Tudela, "in the Queen of Cities, that the tributes of the Greek Empire are annually deposited, and the lofty towers are filled with precious magazines of silk, purple, and gold. It is said that Constantinople pays each day to her sovereign 20,000 pieces of gold, which are levied on the shops, taverns, and markets, on the merchants of Persia and Egypt, of Russia and Hungary, of Italy and Spain, who frequent the capital by sea and land." In all pecuniary matters, the authority of a Jew is doubtless respectable. But as the 365 days would produce a yearly income exceeding 7 million sterling, I am tempted to retrench at least the numerous festivals of the Greek calendar. The mass of treasure that was saved by Theodora and Basil II will suggest a splendid, though indefinite, idea of their supplies and resources. The mother of Michael, before she retired to a cloister, attempted to check or expose the prodigality of her ungrateful son by a free and faithful account of the wealth which he inherited. 109,000 pounds of gold and 300,000 of silver, the fruits of her own economy and that of her deceased husband. The avarice of Basil is not less renowned than his valor and fortune. His victorious armies were paid and rewarded without breaking into the mass of 200,000 pounds of gold, about 8 million sterling, which he had buried in the subterraneous vaults of the palace. Such accumulation of treasure is rejected by the theory and practice of modern policy, and we are more apt to compute the national riches by the use and abuse of the public credit. Yet the maxims of antiquity are still embraced by a monarch formidable to his enemies, by a republic respectable to her allies. And both have attained their respective ends of military power and domestic tranquility. Whatever might be consumed for the present wants or reserved for the future use of the state, the first and most sacred demand was for the pomp and pleasure of the emperor, and his discretion only could define the measure of his private expense. The princes of Constantinople were far removed from the simplicity of nature, yet with the revolving seasons they were led by taste or fashion to withdraw to a purer air from the smoke and tumult of the capital. They enjoyed, or affected to enjoy, the rustic festival of the vintage. Their leisure was amused by the exercise of the chase and the calmer occupation of fishing, and in the summer heats they were shaded from the sun and refreshed by the cooling breezes from the sea. The coasts and islands of Asia and Europe were covered with their magnificent villas, but instead of the modest art which secretly strives to hide itself and to decorate the scenery of nature, the marble structure of their gardens served only to expose the riches of the lord and the labors of the architect. The successive casualties of inheritance and forfeiture had rendered the sovereign proprietor of many stately houses in the city and suburbs, of which 12 were appropriated to the ministers of state. But the great palace, the center of the imperial residence, was fixed during 11 centuries to the same position between the hippodrome, the cathedral of Santa Sophia, and the gardens, which descended by many a terrace to the shores of the Propontis. The primitive edifice of the first Constantine was a copy, or rival, of ancient Rome. The gradual improvements of his successors aspired to emulate the wonders of the old world, and in the 10th century the Byzantine palace excited the admiration, at least of the Latins, by an unquestionable preeminence of strength, size, and magnificence. But the toil and treasure of so many ages had produced a vast and irregular pile. Each separate building was marked with the character of the times and of the founder, and the want of space might excuse the reigning monarch, who demolished, perhaps with secret satisfaction, the works of his predecessors. The economy of the Emperor Theophilus allowed a more free and ample scope for his domestic luxury and splendor. A favorite ambassador, who had astonished the Abbasides themselves by his pride and liberality, presented on his return the model of a palace which the Caliph of Baghdad had recently constructed on the banks of the Tigris. The model was instantly copied and surpassed. The new buildings of Theophilus were accompanied with gardens and with five churches, one of which was conspicuous for size and beauty. It was crowned with three domes, the roof of gilt brass reposed on columns of Italian marble, and the walls were encrusted with marbles of various colors. In the face of the church, a semicircular portico of the figure and name of the Greek Sigma was supported by 15 columns of Phrygian marble, and the subterraneous vaults were of a similar construction. The square before the Sigma was decorated with a fountain, and the margin of the basin was lined and encompassed with plates of silver. In the beginning of each season, the basin, instead of water, was replenished with the most exquisite fruits, which were abandoned to the populace for the entertainment of the prince. He enjoyed this tumultuous spectacle from a throne resplendent with gold and gems, which was raised by a marble staircase to the height of a lofty terrace. Below the throne were seated the officers of his guards, the magistrates, the chiefs of the factions of the circus. The inferior steps were occupied by the people, and the place below was covered with troops of dancers, singers, and pantomimes. The square was surrounded by the Hall of Justice, the Arsenal, and the various offices of business and pleasure, and the Purple Chamber was named from the annual distribution of robes of scarlet and purple by the hand of the Empress herself. The long series of the apartments was adapted to the seasons and decorated with marble and porphyry, with painting, sculpture, and mosaics, with a profusion of gold, silver, and precious stones. His fanciful magnificence employed the skill and patience of such artists as the times could afford, but the taste of Athens would have despised their frivolous and costly labors. A golden tree, with its leaves and branches, which sheltered a multitude of birds warbling their artificial notes, and two lions of massy gold and of natural size, who looked and roared like their brethren of the forest. The successors of Theophilus, of the Basilian and Comnenian dynasties, were not less ambitious of leaving some memorial of their residence, and the portion of the palace most splendid and august was dignified with the title of the Golden Triclinium. With becoming modesty, the rich and noble Greeks aspired to imitate their sovereign, and when they passed through the streets on horseback in their robes of silk and embroidery, they were mistaken by the children for kings. A matron of Peloponnesus, who had cherished the infant fortunes of Basil the Macedonian, was excited by tenderness or vanity to visit the greatness of her adopted son. In a journey of 500 miles from Patras to Constantinople, her age or indolence declined the fatigue of a horse or carriage. The soft litter or bed of Danielis was transported on the shoulders of 10 robust slaves. And as they were relieved at easy distances, a band of 300 were selected for the performance of this service. She was entertained in the Byzantine palace with filial reverence and the honors of a queen. And whatever might be the origin of her wealth, her gifts were not unworthy of the regal dignity. I have already described the fine and curious manufactures of Peloponnesus, of linen, silk, and woolen. But the most acceptable of her presents consisted in 300 beautiful youths, of whom 100 were eunuchs. "For she was not ignorant," says the historian, "that the air of the palace is more congenial to such insects than a shepherd's dairy to the flies of the summer." During her lifetime, she bestowed the greater part of her estates in Peloponnesus, and her testament instituted Leo, the son of Basil, her universal heir. After the payment of the legacies, 40 villas or farms were added to the imperial domain, and 3,000 slaves of Danielis were enfranchised by their new lord and transplanted as a colony to the Italian coast. From this example of a private matron, we may estimate the wealth and magnificence of the emperors. Yet our enjoyments are confined by a narrow circle, and whatsoever may be its value, the luxury of life is possessed with more innocence and safety by the master of his own than by the steward of the public fortune. In an absolute government which levels the distinctions of noble and plebeian birth, the sovereign is the sole fountain of honour, and the rank, both in the palace and the empire, depends on the titles and offices which are bestowed and resumed by his arbitrary will. Above 1,000 years, from Vespasian to Alexius Comnenus, the Caesar was the second person, or at least the second degree, after the supreme title of Augustus was more freely communicated to the sons and brothers of the reigning monarch. To elude without violating his promise to a powerful associate, the husband of his sister, and without giving himself an equal, to reward the piety of his brother Isaac, the crafty Alexius interposed a new and supereminent dignity. The happy flexibility of the Greek tongue allowed him to compound the names of Augustus and Emperor, Sebastus and Autocrator, and the union produces the sonorous title of Sebastocrator. He was exalted above the Caesar on the first step of the throne. The public acclamations repeated his name, and he was only distinguished from the sovereign by some peculiar ornaments of the head and feet. The emperor alone could assume the purple or red buskins, and the close diadem or tiara, which imitated the fashion of the Persian kings. It was a high pyramidal cap of cloth or silk, almost concealed by profusion of pearls and jewels. The crown was formed by a horizontal circle and 2 arches of gold. At the summit, the point of their intersection, was placed a globe or cross, and 2 strings, or lappets of pearl, depended on either cheek. Instead of red, the buskins of the Sebastocrator and Caesar were green, and on their open coronets or crowns, the precious gems were more sparingly distributed. Beside and below the Caesar, the fancy of Alexius created the Panhypersebastus and the Protosebastus, whose sound and signification will satisfy a Grecian ear. They imply a superiority and a priority above the simple name of Augustus, and this sacred and primitive title of the Roman prince was degraded to the kinsmen and servants of the Byzantine court. The daughter of Alexius applauds with fond complacency this artful gradation of hopes and honours, but the science of words is accessible to the meanest capacity, and this vain dictionary was easily enriched by the pride of his successors. To their favourite sons or brothers they imparted the more lofty appellation of lord or despot, which was illustrated with new ornaments and prerogatives, and placed immediately after the person of the emperor himself. The titles of 1. Despot, 2. Sebastocrator, 3. Caesar, 4. Panhypersebastus, and 5. Protosebastus were usually confined to the princes of his blood. They were the emanations of his majesty, but as they exercised no regular functions, their existence was useless and their authority precarious. But in every monarchy the substantial powers of government must be divided and exercised by the ministers of the palace and treasury, the fleet and army. The titles alone can differ, and in the revolution of ages the counts and prefects, the praetor and quaestor, insensibly descended while their servants rose above their heads to the first honours of the state. In a monarchy which refers every object to the person of the prince, the care and ceremonies of the palace form the most respectable department. The Curopalata, so illustrious in the age of Justinian, was supplanted by the Protovestiare, whose primitive functions were limited to the custody of the wardrobe. From thence his jurisdiction was extended over the numerous menials of pomp and luxury, and he presided with his silver wand at the public and private audience. In the ancient system of Constantine, the name of logothete, or accountant, was applied to the receivers of the finances. The principal officers were distinguished as the logothetes of the domain, of the posts, the army, the private and public treasure. And the great logothete, the supreme guardian of the laws and revenues, is compared with the chancellor of the Latin monarchies. His discerning eye pervaded the civil administration, and he was assisted in due subordination by the eparch, or prefect of the city, the first secretary, and the keepers of the privy seal, the archives, and the red or purple ink which was reserved for the sacred signature of the emperor alone. The introductor and interpreter of foreign ambassadors were the great Kiaus and the Dragoman, two names of Turkish origin and which are still familiar to the Sublime Porte. From the humble style and service of guards, the domestics insensibly rose to the station of generals. The military themes of the East and West, the legions of Europe and Asia, were often divided, till the great domestic was finally invested with the universal and absolute command of the land forces. The protostrator, in his original functions, was the assistant of the emperor when he mounted on horseback. He gradually became the lieutenant of the great domestic in the field, and the jurisdiction extended over the stables, the cavalry, and the royal train of hunting and hawking. The stratopedarch was the great judge of the camp. The protospather commanded the guards. The constable, the great iteriarch, and the acolyth were the separate chiefs of the Franks, the barbarians, and the Varangi, or English, the mercenary strangers who, at the decay of the national spirit, form the nerve of the Byzantine armies. The naval powers were under the command of the great duke. In his absence, they obeyed the great Drungar of the fleet, and in his place the emir, or admiral, a name of Saracen extraction, but which has been naturalized in all the modern languages of Europe. Of these officers, and of many more whom it would be useless to enumerate, the civil and military hierarchy was framed. Their honors and emoluments, their dress and titles, their mutual salutations and respective preeminence were balanced with more exquisite labor than would have fixed the constitution of a free people. And the code was almost perfect when this baseless fabric, the monument of pride and servitude, was forever buried in the ruins of the empire. The most lofty titles and the most humble postures which devotion has applied to the supreme being have been prostituted by flattery and fear to creatures of the same nature with ourselves. The mode of adoration, of falling prostrate on the ground and kissing the feet of the emperor, was borrowed by Diocletian from Persian servitude, but it was continued and aggravated till the last age of the Greek monarchy. Excepting only on Sundays, when it was waived from a motive of religious pride, this humiliating reverence was exacted from all who entered the royal presence, from the princes invested with the diadem and purple, and from the ambassadors who represented their independent sovereigns, the caliphs of Asia, Egypt, or Spain, the kings of France and Italy, and the Latin emperors of ancient Rome. In his Transactions of Business, Liutprand, Bishop of Cremona, asserted the free spirit of a Frank and the dignity of his master Otho. Yet his sincerity cannot disguise the abasement of his first audience. When he approached the throne, the birds of the golden tree began to warble their notes, which were accompanied by the roarings of the two lions of gold. With his two companions, Liut Prant was compelled to bow and to fall prostrate, and thrice to touch the ground with his forehead. He arose, but in the short interval the throne had been hoisted from the floor to the ceiling. The imperial figure appeared in new and more gorgeous apparel, and the interview was concluded in haughty and majestic silence. In this honest and curious narrative, the Bishop of Cremona represents the ceremonies of the Byzantine court, which are still practiced in the Sublime Porte, and which were preserved in the last age by the Dukes of Muscovy or Russia. After a long journey by sea and land, from Venice to Constantinople, the ambassador halted at the Golden Gate till he was conducted by the formal officers to the hospitable palace prepared for his reception. But this palace was a prison, and his jealous keepers prohibited all social intercourse either with strangers or natives. At his first audience he offered the gifts of his master, slaves and golden vases and costly armor. The ostentatious payment of the officers and troops displayed before his eyes the riches of the empire. He was entertained at a royal banquet, in which the ambassadors of the nations were marshalled with the esteem or contempt of the Greeks. From his own table the emperor, as the most signal favor, sent the plates which he had tasted, and his favorites were dismissed with a robe of honor. In the morning and evening of each day his civil and military servants attended their duty in the palace. Their labors were repaid by the sight, perhaps by the smile, of their lord. His commands were signified by nod or a sign, but all earthly greatness stood silent and submissive in his presence. In his regular or extraordinary processions through the capital, he unveiled his person to the public view. The rites of policy were connected with those of religion, and his visits to the principal churches were regulated by the festivals of the Greek calendar. On the eve of these processions, the gracious or devout intention of the monarch was proclaimed by the heralds. The streets were cleared and purified. The pavement was strewn with flowers. The most precious furniture, the gold and silver plate and silken hangings, were displayed from the windows and balconies, and a severe discipline restrained and silenced the tumult of the populace. The march was opened by the military officers at the head of their troops. They were followed in long order by the magistrates and ministers of the civil government. The person of the emperor was guarded by his eunuchs and domestics, and at the church door he was solemnly received by the patriarch and his clergy. The task of applause was not abandoned to the rude and spontaneous voices of the crowd. The most convenient stations were occupied by the bands of the blue and green factions of the circus, and their furious conflicts, which had shaken the capital, were insensibly sunk to an emulation of servitude. From either side they echoed in responsive melody the praises of the emperor. Their poets and musicians directed the choir, and long life and victory were the burden of every song. The same acclamations were performed at the audience, the banquet, and the church, and as an evidence of boundless sway, they were repeated in the Latin, Gothic, Persian, French, and even English language, by the mercenaries who sustain the real or fictitious character of those nations. By the pen of Constantine Porphyrogenitus, this science of form and flattery has been reduced into a pompous and trifling volume, which the vanity of succeeding times might enrich with an ample supplement. Yet the calmer reflection of a prince would surely suggest that the same acclamations were applied to every character and every reign, and if he had risen from a private rank, he might remember that his own voice had been the loudest and most eager in applause at the very moment when he envied the fortune or conspired against the life of his predecessor. The princes of the north, of the nations, says Constantine, without faith or fame, were ambitious of mingling their blood with the blood of the Caesars by their marriage with a royal virgin or by the nuptials of their daughters with a Roman prince. The aged monarch, in his instructions to his son, reveals the secret maxims of policy and pride, and suggests the most decent reasons for refusing these insolent and unreasonable demands. Every animal, says the discreet emperor, is prompted by the distinction of language, religion, and manners. A just regard to the purity of descent preserves the harmony of public and private life. But the mixture of foreign blood is the fruitful source of disorder and discord. Such had ever been the opinion and practice of the sage Romans. Their jurisprudence prescribed the marriage of a citizen and a stranger. In the days of freedom and virtue, a senator would have scorned to match his daughter with a king. The glory of Mark Antony was sullied by an Egyptian wife, and the emperor Titus was compelled by popular censure to dismiss with reluctance the reluctant Berenice. This perpetual interdict was ratified by the fabulous sanction of the great Constantine. The ambassadors of the nations, more especially of the unbelieving nations, were solemnly admonished that such strange alliances had been condemned by the founder of the church and city. The irrevocable law was inscribed on the altar of Santa Sophia, and the impious prince, who should stain the majesty of the purple, was excluded from the civil and ecclesiastical communion of the Romans. If the ambassadors were instructed by any false brethren in the Byzantine history, they might produce three memorable examples of the violation of this imaginary law. The marriage of Leo, or rather of his father Constantine IV, with the daughter of the king of the Khazars. The nuptials of the granddaughter of Romanus with a Bulgarian prince. And the union of Berta of France, or Italy, with young Romanus, the son of Constantine Porphyrogenitus himself. To these objections, three answers were prepared, which solved the difficulty and established the law. The deed and the guilt of Constantine Copronymus were acknowledged. The Isaurian heretic, who sullied the baptismal font, had declared war against the holy images, had indeed embraced a barbarian wife. By this impious alliance, he accomplished the measure of his crimes and was devoted to the just censure of the church and of posterity. Romanus could not be alleged as a legitimate emperor. He was a plebeian usurper, ignorant of the laws and regardless of the honor of the monarchy. His son Christopher, the father of the bride, was the third in rank in the College of Princes, at once the subject and the accomplice of a rebellious parent. The Bulgarians were sincere and devout Christians, and the safety of the empire, with the redemption of many thousand captives, depended on this preposterous alliance. Yet no consideration could dispense from the law of Constantine. The clergy, the senate, and the people disapproved the conduct of Romanus, and he was reproached, both in his life and death, as the author of the public disgrace. For the marriage of his own son with the daughter of Hugo, king of Italy, a more honorable defense is contrived by the wise Porphyrogenitus. Constantine, the great and holy, esteemed the fidelity and valor of the Franks, and his prophetic spirit beheld the vision of their future greatness. They alone were accepted from the general prohibition. Hugo, king of France, was the lineal descendant of Charlemagne, and his daughter, Berta, inherited the prerogatives of her family and nation. The voice of truth and malice insensibly betrayed the fraud or error of the imperial court. The patrimonial estate of Hugo was reduced from the monarchy of France to the simple county of Arles, though it was not denied that in the confusion of the times he had usurped the sovereignty of Provence and invaded the kingdom of Italy. His father was a private noble, and if Berta derived her female descent from the Carlovingian line, every step was polluted with illegitimacy or vice. The grandmother of Hugo was the famous Valdrada, the concubine, rather than the wife of the second Lothair, whose adultery, divorce, and second nuptials had provoked against him the thunders of the Vatican. His mother, as she was styled, the Great Berta, was successively the wife of the Count of Arles and of the Marquis of Tuscany. France and Italy were scandalized by her gallantries, and till the age of 80, her lovers of every degree were the zealous servants of her ambition. The example of maternal incontinence was copied by the King of Italy, and the three favorite concubines of Hugo were decorated with the classic names of Venus, Juno, and Semele. The daughter of Venus was granted to the solicitations of the Byzantine court. Her name of Berta was changed to that of Eudoxia, and she was wedded, or rather betrothed, to young Romanus, the future heir of the Empire of the East. The consummation of this foreign alliance was suspended by the tender age of the two parties, and at the end of 5 years, the union was dissolved by the death of the virgin's spouse. The second wife of the emperor, Romanus, was a maiden of plebeian, but of Roman birth, and their two daughters, Theophano and Anne, were given in marriage to the princes of the earth. The eldest was bestowed as the pledge of peace on the eldest son of the great Otho, who had solicited this alliance with arms and embassies. It might legally be questioned how far a Saxon was entitled to the privilege of the French nation, but every scruple was silenced by the fame and piety of a hero who had restored the empire of the West. After the death of her father-in-law and husband, Theophano governed Rome, Italy, and Germany during the minority of her son, the third Otho, and the Latins have praised the virtues of an empress who sacrificed to a superior duty the remembrance of her country. In the nuptials of her sister Anne, every prejudice was lost, and every consideration of dignity was superseded by the stronger argument of necessity and fear. A pagan of the north, Volodomir, great prince of Russia, aspired to a daughter of the Roman purple, and his claim was enforced by the threats of war, the promise of conversion, and the offer of a powerful succor against a domestic rebel. A victim of her religion and country, the Grecian princess was torn from the palace of her fathers and condemned to a savage reign and a hopeless exile on the banks of the Borysthenes or in the neighborhood of the Polar Circle. Yet the marriage of Anne was fortunate and fruitful. The daughter of her grandson, Yaroslaus, was recommended by her imperial descent, and the King of France, Henry I, sought a wife on the last borders of Europe and Christendom. In the Byzantine palace, the emperor was the first slave of the ceremonies which he imposed, of the rigid forms which regulated each word and gesture, besieged him in the palace and violated the leisure of his rural solitude. But the lives and fortunes of millions hung on his arbitrary will, and the firmest minds, superior to the allurements of pomp and luxury, may be seduced by the more active pleasure of commanding their equals. The legislative and executive powers were centered in the person of the monarch, and the last remains of the authority of the Senate were finally eradicated by Leo the philosopher. A lethargy of servitude had benumbed the minds of the Greeks. In the wildest tumults of rebellion, they never aspired to the idea of a free constitution, and the private character of the prince was the only source and measure of their public happiness. Superstition riveted their chains. In the church of Santa Sophia, he was solemnly crowned by the patriarch. At the foot of the altar, they pledged their passive and unconditional obedience to his government and family. On his side, he engaged to abstain as much as possible from the capital punishments of death and mutilation. His orthodox creed was subscribed with his own hand, and he promised to obey the decrees of the seven synods and the canons of the Holy Church. But the assurance of mercy was loose and indefinite. He swore not to his people, but to an invisible judge. And except in the inexpiable guilt of heresy, the ministers of heaven were always prepared to preach the indefeasible right and to absolve the venial transgressions of their sovereign. The Greek ecclesiastics were themselves the subjects of the civil magistrate. At the nod of a tyrant, the bishops were created, or transferred, or deposed, or punished with an ignominious death. Whatever might be their wealth or influence, they could never succeed like the Latin clergy in the establishment of an independent republic. And the Patriarch of Constantinople condemned what he secretly envied, the temporal greatness of his Roman brother. Yet the exercise of boundless despotism is happily checked by the laws of nature and necessity. In proportion to his wisdom and virtue, the master of an empire is confined to the path of his sacred and laborious duty. In proportion to his vice and folly, he drops the scepter too weighty for his hands, and the motions of the royal image are ruled by the imperceptible thread of some minister or favorite who undertakes for his private interest to exercise the task of the public oppression. In some fatal moment, the most absolute monarch may dread the reason or the caprice of a nation of slaves, and experience has proved that whatever is gained in the extent is lost in the safety and solidity of regal power. Whatever titles a despot may assume, whatever claims he may assert, it is on the sword that he must ultimately depend to guard him against his foreign and domestic enemies. From the age of Charlemagne to that of the Crusades, the world, for I overtook the remote monarchy of China, was occupied and disputed by the three great empires or nations of the Greeks, the Saracens, and the Franks. Their military strength may be ascertained by a comparison of their courage, their arts and riches, and their obedience to a supreme head who might call into action all the energies of the state. The Greeks, far inferior to their rivals in the first, were superior to the Franks and at least equal to the Saracens in the second and third of these warlike qualifications. The wealth of the Greeks enabled them to purchase the service of the poorer nations, and to maintain a naval power for the protection of their coasts and the annoyance of their enemies. A commerce of mutual benefit exchanged the gold of Constantinople for the blood of Sclavonians and Turks, the Bulgarians and Russians. Their valor contributed to the victories of Nicephorus and Zimisces. And if a hostile people pressed too closely on the frontier, they were recalled to the defense of their country and the desire of peace by the well-managed attack of a more distant tribe. The command of the Mediterranean from the mouth of the Tanais to the columns of Hercules was always claimed and often possessed by the successors of Constantine. Their capital was filled with naval stores and dexterous artificers. The situation of Greece and Asia, the long coasts, deep gulfs, and numerous islands accustomed their subjects to the exercise of navigation, and the trade of Venice and Amalfi supplied a nursery of seamen to the imperial fleet. Since the time of the Peloponnesian and Punic Wars, the sphere of action had not been enlarged, and the science of naval architecture appears to have declined. The art of constructing those stupendous machines which displayed 3 or 6 or 10 ranges of oars, rising above or falling behind each other, was unknown to the shipbuilders of Constantinople as well as to the mechanisms of modern days. The dromones, or light galleys, of the Byzantine Empire were content with 2-tier of oars. Each tier was composed of 5 and 20 benches, and 2 rowers were seated on each bench, who plied their oars on either side of the vessel. To these we must add the captain or centurion, who in time of action stood erect with his armor-bearer on the poop, 2 steersmen at the helm, and 2 officers at the prow, the one to manage the anchor, the other to point and play against the enemy the tube of liquid fire. The whole crew, as in the infancy of the art, performed the double service of mariners and soldiers. They were provided with defensive and offensive arms, with bows and arrows, which they used from the upper deck, with long pikes, which they pushed through the portholes of the lower tier. Sometimes, indeed, the ships of war were of a larger and more solid construction, and the labors of combat and navigation were more regularly divided between 70 soldiers and 230 mariners. But, for the most part, they were of the light and manageable size, and as the Cape of Malea in Peloponnesus was still clothed with its ancient terrors, an imperial fleet was transported 5 miles overland across the Isthmus of Corinth. The principles of maritime tactics had not undergone any change since the time of Thucydides. His squadron of galleys still advanced in a crescent, charged to the front, and strove to impel their sharp beaks against the feeble sides of their antagonists. A machine for casting stones and darts was built of strong timbers in the midst of the deck, and the operation of boarding was effected by a crane that hoisted baskets of armed men. The language of signals, so clear and copious in the naval grammar of the moderns, was imperfectly expressed by the various positions and colors of a commanding flag. In the darkness of the night, the same orders to chase, to attack, to halt, to retreat, to break, to form, were conveyed by the lights of the leading galley. By land, the fire signals were repeated from one mountain to another. A chain of 8 stations commanded a space of 500 miles. And Constantinople, in a few hours, was apprised of the hostile motions of the Saracens of Tarsus. Some estimate may be formed of the power of the Greek emperors by the curious and minute detail of the armament which was prepared for the reduction of Crete. A fleet of 112 galleys and 75 vessels of the Pamphylian style was equipped in the capital, the islands of the Aegean Sea, and the seaports of Asia, Macedonia, and Greece. It carried 34,000 mariners, 7,340 soldiers, 700 Russians, and 5,087 Mardaites, whose fathers had been transplanted from the mountains of Libanus. Their pay, most probably of a month, was computed at 34 centenaries of gold, about 136,000 pounds sterling. Our fancy is bewildered by the endless recapitulation of arms and engines, of clothes and linen, of bread for the men and forage for the horses, and of stores and utensils of every description, inadequate to the conquest of a petty island, but amply sufficient for the establishment of a flourishing colony. The invention of the Greek fire did not, like that of gunpowder, produce a total revolution in the art of war. To these liquid combustibles the city and empire of Constantine owed their deliverance, and they were employed in sieges and sea fights with terrible effect. But they were either less improved or less susceptible of improvement. The engines of antiquity, the catapulti, ballistae, and battering rams, were still of most frequent and powerful use in the attack and defense of fortifications. Nor was the decision of battles reduced to the quick and heavy fire of a line of infantry, whom it were fruitless to protect with armor against a similar fire of their enemies. Steel and iron were still the common instruments of destruction and safety, and the helmets, cuirasses, and shields of the 10th century did not either in form or substance essentially differ from those which had covered the companions of Alexander or Achilles. But instead of accustoming the modern Greeks, like the legionaries of old, to the constant and easy use of this salutary weight, their armor was laid aside in light chariots which followed the march, till, on the approach of an enemy, they resumed with haste and reluctance the unusual encumbrance. Their offensive weapons consisted of swords, battle axes, and spears, but the Macedonian pike was shortened a fourth of its length and reduced to the more convenient measure of 12 cubits, or feet. The sharpness of the Scythian and Arabian arrows had been severely felt, and the emperors lament the decay of archery as a cause of the public misfortunes, and recommend, as an advice and a command, that the military youth, till the age of 40, should assiduously practice the exercise of the bow. The bands or regiments were usually 300 strong, and as a medium between the extremes of 4 and 16, the foot soldiers of Leo and Constantine were formed 8 deep. But the cavalry charged in 4 ranks from the reasonable consideration that the weight of the front could not be increased by any pressure of the hindmost horses. If the ranks of the infantry or cavalry were sometimes doubled, this cautious array betrayed a secret distrust of the courage of the troops, whose numbers might swell the appearance of the line, but of whom only a chosen band would dare to encounter the spears and swords of the barbarians. The order of battle must have varied according to the ground, the object, and the adversary. But their ordinary disposition in 2 lines and a reserve presented a succession of hopes and resources most agreeable to the temper as well as the judgment of the Greeks. In case of a repulse, the first line fell back into the intervals of the second, and the reserve, breaking into 2 divisions, wheeled round the flanks to improve the victory or cover the retreat. Whatever authority could enact was accomplished, at least in theory, by the camps and marches, the exercises and evolutions, the edicts and books of the Byzantine monarch. Whatever art could produce from the forge, the loom, or the laboratory was abundantly supplied by the riches of the prince and the industry of his numerous workmen. But neither authority nor art could frame the most important machine, the soldier himself. And if the ceremonies of Constantine always supposed the safe and triumphal return of the emperor, his tactics seldom soar above the means of escaping a defeat and procrastinating the war. Notwithstanding some transient success, the Greeks were sunk in their own esteem and that of their neighbors. A cold hand and a loquacious tongue was the vulgar description of the nation. The author of the tactics was besieged in his capital, and the last of the barbarians, who trembled at the name of the Saracens or Franks, could proudly exhibit the medals of gold and silver which they had extorted from the feeble sovereign of Constantinople. What spirit their government and character denied might have been inspired in some degree by the influence of religion. But the religion of the Greeks could only teach them to suffer and to yield. The Emperor Nicephorus, who restored, for a moment, the discipline and glory of the Roman name, was desirous of bestowing the honors of martyrdom on the Christians who lost their lives in a holy war against the infidels. But this political law was defeated by the opposition of the Patriarch, the bishops, and the principal senators, and they strenuously urged the canons of St. Basil, that all who were polluted by the bloody trade of a soldier should be separated during 3 years from the communion of the faithful. These scruples of the Greeks have been compared with the tears of the primitive Muslims when they were held back from battle, and this contrast of base superstition and high-spirited enthusiasm unfolds to a philosophic eye the history of the rival nations. The subjects of the last caliphs had undoubtedly degenerated from the zeal and faith of the companions of the prophet, yet their martial creed still represented the deity as the author of war. The vital, though latent, spark of fanaticism still glowed in the heart of their religion, and among the Saracens who dwelt on the Christian borders, it was frequently rekindled to a lively and active flame. Their regular force was formed of the valiant slaves who had been educated to guard the person and accompany the standard of their lord. But the Muslim people of Syria and Cilicia, of Africa and Spain, was awakened by the trumpet which proclaimed a holy war against the infidels. The rich were ambitious of death or victory in the cause of God. The poor were allured by the hopes of plunder, and the old, the infirm, and the women assumed their share of meritorious service by sending their substitutes with arms and horses into the field. These offensive and defensive arms were similar in strength and temper to those of the Romans, whom they far excelled in the management of the horse and the bow. The massy silver of their belts, their bridles, and their swords displayed the magnificence of a prosperous nation, and except some black archers of the south, the Arabs disdained the naked bravery of their ancestors. Instead of wagons, they were attended by a long train of camels, mules, and asses. The multitude of these animals, whom they bedecked with flags and streamers, appeared to swell the pomp and magnitude of their host, and the horses of the enemy were often disordered by the uncouth figure and odious smell of the camels of the east. Invincible by their patience of thirst and heat, their spirits were frozen by winter's cold, and the consciousness of their propensity to sleep exacted the most rigorous precautions against the surprises of the night. Their order of battle was a long square of two deep and solid lines, the first of archers, the second of cavalry. In their engagements by sea and land, they sustained with patient firmness the fury of the attack, and seldom advanced to the charge till they could discern and oppress the lassitude of their foes. But if they were repulsed and broken, they knew not how to rally or renew the combat, and their dismay was heightened by the superstitious prejudice that God had declared himself on the side of their enemies. The decline and fall of the caliphs countenanced this fearful opinion, nor were there wanting among the Mohammedans and Christians some obscure prophecies which prognosticated their alternate defeats. The unity of the Arabian Empire was dissolved, but the independent fragments were equal to populous and powerful kingdoms, and in their naval and military armaments an emir of Aleppo or Tunis might command no despicable fund of skill and industry and treasure. In their transactions of peace and war with the Saracens, the princes of Constantinople too often felt that these barbarians had nothing barbarous in their discipline, and that if they were destitute of original genius, they had been endowed with a quick spirit of curiosity and imitation. The model was indeed more perfect than the copy. Their ships and engines and fortifications were of a less skillful construction, and they confess, without shame, that the same God who has given a tongue to the Arabians had more nicely fashioned the hands of the Chinese and the heads of the Greeks. A name of some German tribes between the Rhine and the Weser had spread its victorious influence over the greatest part of Gaul, Germany, and Italy, and the common appellation of Franks was applied by the Greeks and Arabians to the Christians of the Latin Church, the nations of the West who stretched beyond their knowledge to the shores of the Atlantic Ocean. The vast body had been inspired and united by the soul of Charlemagne. But the division and degeneracy of his race soon annihilated the imperial power, which would have rivaled the Caesars of Byzantium and revenged the indignities of the Christian name. The enemies no longer feared, nor could the subjects any longer trust the application of a public revenue, the labors of trade and manufactures in the military service, the mutual aid of provinces and armies, and the naval squadrons which were regularly stationed from the mouth of the Elbe to that of the Tiber. In the beginning of the 10th century, the family of Charlemagne had almost disappeared. His monarchy was broken into many hostile and independent states. The regal title was assumed by the most ambitious chiefs. Their revolt was imitated in a long subordination of anarchy and discord, and the nobles of every province disobeyed their sovereign, oppressed their vassals, and exercised perpetual hostilities against their equals and neighbors. Their private wars, which overturned the fabric of government, fomented the martial spirit of the nation. In the system of modern Europe, the power of the sword is possessed, at least in fact, by five or six mighty potentates. Their operations are conducted on a distant frontier, by an order of men who devote their lives to the study and practice of the military art. The rest of the country and community enjoys, in the midst of war, the tranquility of peace, and is only made sensible of the change by the aggravation or decrease of the public taxes. In the disorders of the 10th and 11th centuries, every peasant was a soldier and every village a fortification. Each wood or valley was a scene of murder and rapine, and the lords of each castle were compelled to assume the character of princes and warriors. To their own courage and policy, they boldly trusted for the safety of their family, the protection of their lands, and the revenge of their injuries. And, like the conquerors of a larger size, they were too apt to transgress the privilege of defensive war. The powers of the mind and body were hardened by the presence of danger and necessity of resolution. The same spirit refused to desert a friend and to forgive an enemy. And instead of sleeping under the guardian care of a magistrate, they proudly disdained the authority of the laws. In the ways of feudal anarchy, the instruments of agriculture and art were converted into the weapons of bloodshed. The peaceful occupations of civil and ecclesiastical society were abolished or corrupted, and the bishop who exchanged his mitre for a helmet was more forcibly urged by the manners of the times than by the obligation of his tenure. The love of freedom and of arms was felt with conscious pride by the Franks themselves, and is observed by the Greeks with some degree of amazement and terror. The Franks, says the Emperor Constantine, are bold and valiant to the verge of temerity, and their dauntless spirit is supported by the contempt of danger and death. In the field and in close onset, they press to the front and rush headlong against the enemy, without deigning to compute either his numbers or their own. Their ranks are formed by the firm connections of consanguinity and friendship, and their martial deeds are prompted by the desire of saving or revenging their dearest companions. In their eyes, a retreat is a shameful flight, and flight is indelible infamy. A nation endowed with such high and intrepid spirit must have been secure of victory if these advantages had not been counterbalanced by many weighty defects. The decay of their naval power left the Greeks and Saracens in possession of the sea for every purpose of annoyance and supply. In the age which preceded the institution of knighthood, the Franks were rude and unskillful in the service of cavalry, and in all perilous emergencies their warriors were so conscious of their ignorance that they chose to dismount from their horses and fight on foot. Unpractised in the use of pikes or of missile weapons, they were encumbered by the length of their swords, the weight of their armor, the magnitude of their shields, and, if I may repeat the satire of the meager Greeks, by their unwieldy intemperance. Their independent spirit disdained the yoke of subordination, and abandoned the standard of their chief if he attempted to keep the field beyond the term of their stipulation or service. On all sides they were open to the snares of an enemy less brave but more artful than themselves. They might be bribed, for the barbarians were venal, or surprised in the night, for they neglected the precautions of a close encampment or vigilant sentinels. The fatigues of a summer's campaign exhausted their strength and patience, and they sunk in despair if their voracious appetite was disappointed of a plentiful supply of wine and of food. This general character of the Franks was marked with some national and local shades which I would ascribe to accident rather than to climate, but which were visible both to natives and to foreigners. An ambassador of the great Otho declared in the palace of Constantinople that the Saxons could dispute with swords better than with pens, and that they preferred inevitable death to the dishonor of turning their backs to an enemy. It was the glory of the nobles of France that in their humble dwellings war and rapine were the only pleasure, the sole occupation of their lives. They affected to deride the palaces, the banquets, the polished manner of the Italians, who in the estimate of the Greeks themselves had degenerated from the liberty and valour of the ancient Lombards. By the well-known edict of Caracalla, his subjects from Britain to Egypt were entitled to the name and privileges of Romans, and their national sovereign might fix his occasional or permanent residence in any province of their common country. In the division of the East and West, an ideal unity was scrupulously observed, and in their titles, laws, and statutes, the successors of Arcadius and Honorius announced themselves as the inseparable colleagues of the same office, as the joint sovereigns of the Roman world and city, which were bounded by the same limits. After the fall of the Western monarchy, the majesty of the purple resided solely in the princes of Constantinople. And of these, Justinian was the first who, after a divorce of 60 years, regained the dominion of ancient Rome and asserted by the right of conquest the august title of Emperor of the Romans. A motive of vanity or discontent solicited one of his successors, Constans II, to abandon the Thracian Bosphorus and to restore the pristine honors of the Tiber. "An extravagant project," exclaims the malicious Byzantine, as if he had despoiled a beautiful and blooming virgin, to enrich, or rather to expose, the deformity of a wrinkled and decrepit matron. But the sword of the Lombards opposed his settlement in Egypt. He entered Rome not as a conqueror, but as a fugitive, and after a visit of 12 days, he pillaged and forever deserted the ancient capital of the world. The final revolt and separation of Italy was accomplished about 2 centuries after the conquests of Justinian, and from his reign we may date the gradual oblivion of the Latin tongue. That legislator had composed his institutes, his code, and his pandects in a language which he celebrates as the proper and public style of the Roman government, the consecrated idiom of the palace and senate of Constantinople, of the campus and tribunals of the East. But this foreign dialect was unknown to the people and soldiers of the Asiatic provinces. It was imperfectly understood by the greater part of the interpreters of the laws and the ministers of the state. After a short conflict, nature and habit prevailed over the obsolete institutions of human power. For the general benefit of his subjects, Justinian promulgated his novels in the 2 languages. The several parts of his voluminous jurisprudence were successively translated. The original was forgotten. The version was studied, and the Greek, whose intrinsic merit deserved indeed the preference, obtained a legal as well as popular establishment in the Byzantine monarchy. The birth and residence of succeeding princes estranged them from the Roman idiom. Tiberius by the Arabs and Maurice by the Italians are distinguished as the first of the Greek Caesars, as the founders of a new dynasty and empire. The silent revolution was accomplished before the death of Heraclius, and the ruins of the Latin speech were darkly preserved in the terms of jurisprudence and the acclamations of the palace. After the restoration of the Western Empire by Charlemagne and the Othos, the names of Franks and Latins acquired an equal signification and extent, and these haughty barbarians asserted with some justice their superior claim to the language and dominion of Rome. They insulted the alien of the East who had renounced the dress and idiom of Romans, and their reasonable practice will justify the frequent appellation of Greeks. But this contemptuous